sense, and my role is symbolic of all impending endings and renunciations. I had a bad night after the last meeting. Everything feels bad at 3 a.m. I had a rush of sorrow at all the endings ahead of me. The ending of the group, of my therapy with all my other patients, the ending of my last good year. So, that's the bitter. The sweet is my pride in you guys. And that includes you, Philip. Pride in your growing independence. Therapists are like parents. A good parent enables a child to gain enough autonomy to leave home and function as an adult. In the same way, a good therapist's aim is to enable patients to leave therapy. Lest there be a misunderstanding, I want to clarify the record, Philip proclaimed. It was not my intention to usurp you last week. My actions were entirely self-protective. I felt inexpressibly agitated by the discussion. I forced myself to remain till the end of the meeting, and then I had to leave. I understand that, Philip. But my preoccupation with endings is so strong now that I may see portents of endings and replacement in benign situations. I'm also aware that, tucked into your disclaimer, is some caring for me. For that I thank you. Philip bowed his head slightly. Julius continued. This agitation you describe sounds important. Should we explore it? There are only 5 meetings left. I urge you to take advantage of this group while there's still time. Though Philip silently shook his head as if to indicate that exploration was not yet possible for him, he was not destined to stay silent permanently. In the following meetings, Philip was inexorably drawn in. Pam opened the next meeting by pertly addressing Gil.
Apology time. I've been thinking about you and think I owe you one. No, I know I owe you one.
Say more. Gil was alert and curious.
A few months ago, I blasted you for never being present, for being so absent and impersonal that I could not bear to listen to you. Remember? That was pretty harsh stuff.
Harsh, yes, interrupted Gil. But necessary. It was good medicine. It got me started on my path. Do you realize I haven't had a drink since that day?
Thanks, but that's not what I'm apologizing for. It's what's happened since. You have changed. You've been present. You've been more upfront and more straight with me than anyone else here. And yet I've been just too self-absorbed to acknowledge you. For that I'm sorry.
Gil accepted the apology. And what about the feedback I've given you? Was any of it helpful?
Well, your term, Chief Justice, shook me up for days. It hit home. It made me think. But the thing that sticks most in my mind was when you said John refused to leave his wife not because of cowardice, but because he didn't want to deal with my rage. That got to me. Really got me thinking. I couldn't get your words out of my mind. And you know what? I decided you were dead right. And John was right to turn away from me. I lost him not because of his deficits, but because of mine. He had had enough of me. A few days ago, I picked up the phone, called him, and said these things to him.
How did he take it?
Very well, after he picked himself up off the floor. We ended up having a nice, amiable talk. Catching up, discussing our courses, mutual students, talking about doing some joint teaching. It was good. He told me I sounded different.
That's great news, Pam, said Julius. Letting go of anger is major progress. I agree you've too much attachment to your hates. I wish we could take an eternal snapshot of this letting go process for future reference, to see exactly how you did it.
It was all non-volitional. I think your maxim, strike when the iron is cold, had something to do with it. My feelings about John have cooled enough to step back and permit rational thought.
And what about,
asked Rebecca, your attachment to your Philip hatred? I think you've never appreciated the monstrous nature of his actions to me.
Not true. I felt for you. I ached for you when you first described it. An awful, awful experience.
But 15 years? Usually things cool in 15 years. What keeps this iron red hot?
Last night, during a very light sleep, I was thinking about my history with Philip and had this image of reaching into my head and grabbing the entire awful cluster of thoughts about him and smashing it on the floor. Then I saw myself bending over, examining the fragments. I could see his face, his seedy apartment, my soiled youth, my disillusionment with academic life. I saw my lost friend Molly. And as I looked at this heap of wreckage, I knew what had happened to me was just unforgivable.
I remember Philip saying that unforgiving and unforgivable were two different things, said Stuart. Right, Philip? Philip nodded.
Not sure I get that, said Tony.
Unforgivable, said Philip. Keeps the responsibility outside of oneself, whereas unforgiving places the responsibility on one's own refusal to forgive.
Tony nodded.
The difference between taking the responsibility for what you do or blaming it on someone else?
Precisely, said Philip.
And, as I've heard Julius say, therapy begins when blame ends and responsibility emerges.
Quoting Julius again, Philip, I like it, said Tony.
You make my words sound better than I do, said Julius. And again, I experience you drawing closer. I like that.
Philip smiled almost imperceptibly.
When it was clear he was not planning to respond further, Julius addressed Pam.
Pam, what are you feeling?
To be honest, I'm floored by how hard everyone struggles to see change in Philip. He picks his nose and everyone oohs and ahs. It's a joke how his pompous and trite remarks arouse such reverence.
Mimicking Philip, she said in a sing-song cadence,
therapy begins when blame ends and responsibility emerges.
Then in a raised voice,
and what about your responsibility, Philip? Not a goddamn word about it except some bullshit about all your brain cells changing and therefore it wasn't you who did anything. No, you weren't there.
After an awkward silence, Rebecca said softly,
Pam, I want to point out that you are able to forgive. You've forgiven a lot of things.
You said you forgave me for my excursion into prostitution.
No victim there, except you,
responded Pam quickly.
And, continued Rebecca, we've all taken note of how you forgave Julius instantly for his indiscretions. You forgave him without knowing or inquiring whether some of his friends were injured by his actions.
Pam softened her voice.
His wife had just died. He was in shock. Imagine losing someone you had loved since high school. Give him a break.
Bonnie pitched in.
You forgave Stuart for his sexual adventure with a troubled lady, and even forgave Gil for withholding his alcoholism from us for so long. You've done a lot of forgiving. Why not Philip?
Pam shook her head.
It's one thing to forgive someone for an offense to someone else. Quite another when you're the victim.
The group listened sympathetically, but nonetheless continued.
And Pam, said Rebecca, I forgive you for trying to make John leave his two young children.
Me too, said Gil. And I'll eventually forgive you for what you did with Tony here.
How about you? Do you forgive yourself for springing that confession day and dumping him in public? That was humiliating. I've apologized publicly for not consulting with him about the confession. I was guilty there of extreme thoughtlessness.
Gil persisted. There's something else, though. Do you forgive yourself for using Tony?
Using Tony? Said Pam. I used Tony? What are you talking about?
Seems like your whole relationship was one thing, and a far more important thing, to him than to you. Seems like you weren't relating so much to Tony, but to others, perhaps even to Philip, through Tony.
Oh, Stuart's cockamamie idea. I've never bought into that, said Pam.
Used, interjected Tony. You think I was used? No complaints here about that. I'm up for being used like that any time.
Come on, Tony, said Rebecca. Stop playing games. Stop thinking with your little head.
Little head?
Your cock.
When Tony broke into a big lascivious smile, Rebecca barked.
You bastard, you knew what I meant. You just wanted to hear me talk dirty. Get serious, Tony. We don't have much time left here. You can't really be saying you weren't affected by what happened with Pam.
Tony stopped smiling. Well, being suddenly dumped felt, you know, thrown away. But I'm still hoping.
Tony, said Rebecca, you've still got a lot of work to do on relating to a woman. Quit begging. It's demeaning. I hear you saying they can use you in any goddamn way they want because there's only one thing you want from them, to get laid. That's belittling yourself, and them too.
I didn't think I was using Tony, said Pam. Everything felt mutual to me. But to be honest, at the time I didn't reflect much. I just acted on automatic pilot.
As did I, long ago.
Automatic pilot.
Philip said softly. Pam was startled. She looked at Philip for a few seconds and then gazed downward.
I have a query for you, said Philip.
When Pam did not look up, he added,
A query for you, Pam.
Pam raised her head and faced him. Other members exchanged glances.
20 minutes ago, you said, disillusionment with academic life. And yet a few weeks ago you said that when you applied to grad school, you seriously considered philosophy, even working on Schopenhauer. If that is so, then I put this question to you. Could I have been that disastrous a teacher?
I never said you were a bad teacher, replied Pam. You were one of the best teachers I've ever had.
Astonished, Philip stared hard at her. Talk about what you're feeling, Philip, urged Julius. When Philip refused to answer, Julius said, You remember everything, every word Pam says. I think she matters a great deal to you.
Philip remained silent. Julius turned toward Pam.
I'm thinking about your words, that Philip was one of the best teachers you ever had. That must have compounded your sense of disappointment and betrayal.
Amen. Thanks, Julius, you're always there.
Stuart repeated her words.
One of the best teachers you ever had. I'm absolutely floored by that. I'm floored by your saying something so generous to Philip. That's a huge step.
Don't make too much of it, said Pam. Julius hit the nail on the head. If anything, his being a good teacher made what he did even more egregious.
Tony, taking to heart Gil's comments about his relationship with Pam, opened the next meeting by addressing Pam directly. This is, like, awkward, but I've been holding something back. I want to say I'm feeling more bummed out about us than I've admitted. I haven't done anything wrong to you. You and I were, together, mutual,
about the sex. And yet now I'm the person non grata.
Persona non grata, whispered Philip gently.
Persona non grata, Tony continued. And I'm feeling being punished. We're not close anymore, and I guess I miss that. It seems like we were once friends, then lovers, and now it's like in limbo. Nothing. You avoid me. And Gil's right. Getting dumped in public was humiliating as hell. Right now I get nothing from you. Not getting laid, not being friends.
Oh, Tony, I am so, so sorry. I know. I made a mistake. We should never have done this. It's awkward for me, too.
So how about our going back to where we were before?
Back to?
Just friends, that's all. Just hanging out after the group, like all the others do here, except for my buddy Philip, who's coming around.
Tony reached over and gave Philip's shoulder an affectionate squeeze.
You know, talking about the group, you telling me about books, all that stuff.
That sounds adult, answered Pam. And it would be a first for me. Usually after an affair I make a clean, tumultuous break.
Bonnie volunteered.
I wonder, Pam, if you keep your distance from Tony because you fear he will interpret a friendly overture as a sexual invitation.
Yeah, exactly. There is that. That's an important part of it.
Tony does get a bit single-minded.
Well, said Gil, there's an obvious remedy. Just clear the air. Be straight with him. Ambiguity makes things worse. A couple of weeks ago, I heard you raise the possibility that maybe the two of you can get together later after the group ends. Is that real or just a phony way of softening the letdown? It just muddies the waters. Keeps Tony hanging.
Yep, right on, said Tony. That statement a couple weeks ago about our possibly continuing sometime in the future was big for me. I'm trying to keep everything on an even keel so I can keep that possibility open.
And, said Julius, in so doing, you forfeit the opportunity of doing some work in yourself while this group and I are still available to you.
You know, Tony, said Rebecca, getting laid is not the most important thing, not the only thing in the world.
I know, that's why I'm bringing this up today. Give me a break.
After a short silence, Julius said,
So, Tony, keep working on this.
Tony faced Pam.
Let's do what Gil said. Clear the air. As adults. What do you want?
What I want is to go back to where we were before. I want you to forgive me for embarrassing you by springing the confession. You're a dear man, Tony, and I care for you. The other day I overheard my undergraduate students using this new term, fuck buddies. Perhaps that's what we were, and it was fun then, but it's a bad idea now or in the future. The group takes precedence. Let's concentrate on working on our stuff.
Okay by me. I'm up for it.
So, Tony, said Julius, you're liberated. You're now free to talk about all the thoughts you've been holding back lately. About yourself, Pam, or the group. In the remaining meetings, the liberated Tony returned to his instrumental role in the group. He urged Pam to deal with her feelings about Philip. When the potential breakthrough following her praise of Philip as a teacher never materialized, he pressed her to work harder on why she kept her resentment of Philip red hot, yet could find forgiveness for others in the group.
I've already said, Pam answered, that obviously it's much easier to forgive others, like Rebecca or Stuart or Gil, because I was not a personal victim of their offenses. My life wasn't altered by what they did. But there's more. I can forgive others here because they've shown remorse, and above all, because they've changed. I've changed. I do believe now it's possible to forgive the person but not the act.
I think I might be capable of forgiving a changed Philip, but he hasn't changed.
You ask why I can forgive Julius? Well, look at him. He never stops giving.
And as I'm sure you've all figured out, he's been giving us a final gift of love. He's teaching us how to die.
I knew the old Philip, and I can attest he's the same man you see sitting here. If anything, he's colder and more arrogant.
After a short pause, she added,
"And an apology from him wouldn't hurt."
"Philip, not changed?" said Tony. "I think you're seeing what you want to see. All those women he used to chase, that's changed."
Tony turned to Philip.
"You haven't really spelled it out, but it's different, right?"
Philip nodded. "My life has been very different. I have been with no woman in 12 years.
"You don't call that change?" Tony asked Pam. "Or reform?" said Gil.
Before Pam could respond, Philip interjected.
"Reform?
No, that's inaccurate. The idea of reformation played no role. Let me clarify. I have not changed my life, or as it's been put here, my sex addiction, by virtue of some moral resolution. I changed because my life was agony, no longer bearable."
"How did you take that final step? Was there a last straw event?" asked Julius.
Philip hesitated as he considered whether to answer Julius. Then he inhaled deeply and began, speaking mechanically as though wound up with a key.
"One night I was driving home after a long orgy with an exceptionally beautiful woman and thought that now, if ever in my life, I had gotten all I wanted. I had had my surfeit. The aroma of sexual juices in the car was overpowering. Everything reeked of fetid flesh. The air, my hands, my hair, my clothes, my breath. It was as though I had just bathed in a tub of female musk. And then, on the horizon of my mind, I could spot it. Desire was gathering strength, readying to rear its head again. That was the moment. Suddenly my life made me sick, and I began to vomit. And it was then..." Philip turned to Julius. "When your comment about my epitaph came to mind. And that was when I realized that Schopenhauer was right. Life is forever a torment, and desire is unquenchable. The wheel of torment would spin forever. I had to find a way to get off the wheel. And it was then that I deliberately set about patterning my life after his."
"And it's worked for you all these years?" said Julius.
"Until now. Until this group."
"But you're so much better now, Philip," said Bonnie. "You're so much more in touch. So much more approachable. I'll tell you the truth. The way you were when you first started here, I mean, I could never have imagined me or anyone else consulting you as a counselor."
"Unfortunately," Philip responded, "being in touch here means that I must share everyone's unhappiness. That simply compounds my misery.
Tell me, how can this being in touch possibly be useful? When I was in life, I was miserable. For the past 12 years, I have been a visitor to life, an observer of the passing show, and..."
Philip spread his fingers and raised and lowered his hands for emphasis.
"I have lived in tranquility. And now that this group has compelled me to once again be in life, I am once again in anguish. I mentioned to you my agitation after that group meeting a few weeks ago. I have not regained my former equanimity."
"I think there's a flaw in your reasoning, Philip," said Stuart.
and that has to do with your statement that you were in life.
Bonnie leaped in.
I was going to say the same thing. I don't believe you were ever in life. Not really in life. You've never talked about having a real loving relationship. I've heard nothing about male friends. And as for women, you say yourself that you were a predator.
That true, Philip? Asked Gil. Have there never been any real relationships?
Philip shook his head. Everyone with whom I've interacted has caused me pain.
Your parents? Asked Stuart.
My father was distant and, I think, chronically depressed. He took his own life when I was 13. My mother died a few years ago, but I had been estranged from her for 20 years. I did not attend her funeral.
Brothers? Sisters? Asked Tony.
Philip shook his head. An only child.
You know what comes to my mind?
Tony interjected.
When I was a kid, I wouldn't eat most things my mother cooked. I'd always say, I don't like it. And she'd always come back with, how do you know you don't like it if you never tasted it?
Your take on life reminds me of that.
Many things, Philip replied, can be known by virtue of pure reason. All of geometry, for example. Or one may have some partial exposure to a painful experience and extrapolate the whole from that. And one may look about, read, observe others.
But your main dude, Schopenhauer, said Tony.
Didn't you say he made a big deal about listening to your own body, of relying on, what'd you say? Your instant experience?
Immediate experience.
Right, immediate experience. So wouldn't you say you're making a major decision on second-rate, second-hand info? I mean, info that's not your own immediate experience?
Your point is well taken, Tony, but I had my fill of direct experience after that confession day session.
Again, you go back to that session, Philip. It seems to have been a turning point, said Julius. Maybe it's time to describe what happened to you that day.
As before, Philip paused, inhaled deeply, and then proceeded to relate in a methodical manner his experience after the end of the meeting. As he spoke of his agitation and his inability to marshal his mind-quieting techniques, he grew visibly agitated. Then, as he described how his mental flotsam did not drift away but lodged in his mind, drops of perspiration glistened on his forehead. And then, as Philip spoke of the reemergence of his brutish, rapacious self, a pool of wetness appeared in the armpits of his pale red shirt, and rivulets of sweat dripped from his chin and nose and down his neck. The room was very still. Everyone was transfixed by Philip's leakage of words and of water. He paused, took another deep breath, and continued. My thoughts lost their coherence. Images flooded pell-mell into my mind, memories I had long forgotten. I remembered some things about my two sexual encounters with Pam. And I saw her face, not her face now, but her face of 15 years ago, with a preternatural vividness. It was radiant. I wanted to hold it, and... Philip was prepared to hold nothing back. Not his raw jealousy, not the caveman mentality of possessing Pam, not even the image of Tony with the Popeye forearms. But he was now overcome by a massive diaphoresis which soaked him to the skin. He stood and strode out of the room, saying, I'm drenched. I have to leave. Tony bolted out after him. 3 or 4 minutes later, the two of them re-entered the room, Philip now wearing Tony's San Francisco Giants sweater, and Tony stripped to his tight black t-shirt. Philip looked at no one but simply collapsed into his seat, obviously exhausted.
Bring him back alive, said Tony.
If I weren't married, said Rebecca,
could fall in love with both you guys for what you just did.
I'm available, said Tony. No comment, said Philip. That's it for me today. I'm drained.
Drained? Your first joke here, Philip. I love it, said Rebecca.
39. Some cannot loosen their own chains, yet can nonetheless liberate their friends. Nietzsche. Fame at last. There are few things that Schopenhauer vilified more than the craving for fame. And yet, oh, how he craved it. Fame plays an important role in his last book, Parerga and Paralipomena, a two-volume compilation of incidental observations, essays, and aphorisms, completed in 1851, 9 years before his death. With a profound sense of accomplishment and relief, he finished the book and said, "I will wipe my pen and say, the rest is silence." But finding a publisher was a challenge. None of his previous publishers would touch it, having lost too much money on his other unread works. Even his magnum opus, The World as Will and Representation, had sold only a few copies and received only a single lackluster review. Finally, one of his loyal evangelists persuaded a Berlin bookseller to publish a printing of 750 copies in 1853. Schopenhauer was to receive 10 free copies, but no royalties. The first volume of Parerga and Paralipomena contains a striking triplet of essays on how to gain and maintain a sense of self-worth. The first essay, What a Man Is, describes how creative thinking results in a sense of inner wealth. Such a path provides self-esteem and enables one to overcome the basic vacuity and boredom of life, which results in a ceaseless pursuit of sexual conquests, travel, and games of chance. The second essay, What a Man Has, dissects one of the major techniques used to compensate for inner poverty, the endless accumulation of possessions, which ultimately results in one becoming possessed by one's possessions. It is the third essay, What a Man Represents, that most clearly expresses his views on fame. A person's self-worth or inner merit is the essential commodity, whereas fame is something secondary, the mere shadow of merit. It is not fame, but that whereby we merit it that is of true value. A man's greatest happiness is not that posterity will know something about him, but he himself will develop thoughts that deserve consideration and preservation for centuries. Self-esteem that is based on inner merit results in personal autonomy, which cannot be wrested from us. It is in our power, whereas fame is never in our power. He knew that ablating the desire for fame was not easy. He likened it to extracting an obstinate, painful thorn from our flesh, and agreed with Tacitus, who wrote, "The thirst for fame is the last thing of all to be laid aside by wise men." And he himself was never able to lay aside the thirst for fame. His writings are permeated with bitterness about his lack of success. He regularly searched newspapers and journals for some mention, any mention of himself or his work. Whenever he was away on a trip, he assigned the scanning task to Julius Frauenstädt, his most loyal evangelist. Though he could not stop chafing at being ignored, he ultimately resigned himself to never knowing fame in his lifetime. In later introductions to his books, he explicitly addressed the future generations who would discover him. And then the unthinkable came. Parerga and Paralipomena, the very book in which he described the folly of pursuing fame, made him famous. In this final work, he softened his pessimism, staunched his flow of Jeremiads, and offered wise instruction on how to live. Though he never renounced his belief that life is but a moldy film on the surface of the earth, and a
useless, disturbing episode in the blissful repose of nothingness. He took a more pragmatic path in the Pururga and Paralipomena. "We have no choice," he said, "but to be condemned to life, and must therefore attempt to live with as little pain as possible." Schopenhauer always viewed happiness as a negative state, an absence of suffering, and treasured Aristotle's maxim, "Not to pleasure but to painlessness do the prudent aspire." Accordingly, Pururga and Paralipomena offers lessons on how to think independently, how to retain skepticism and rationality, how to avoid soothing supernatural emollients, how to think well of ourselves, keep our stakes low, and avoid attaching ourselves to what can be lost. Even though everyone must act in life's great puppet play and feel the wire which sets us into motion, there is, nonetheless, comfort in maintaining the philosopher's lofty perspective that, from the aspect of eternity, nothing really matters. Everything passes. Pururga and Paralipomena introduces a new tone. While it continues to emphasize the tragic and lamentable suffering of existence, it adds the dimension of connectivity. That is, through the commonality of our suffering, we are inexorably connected to one another. In one remarkable passage, the great misanthrope displays a softer, more indulgent view of his fellow bipeds. The really proper address between one man and another should be, instead of "Sir, Monsieur," "My fellow sufferer." However strange this may sound, it accords with the facts, puts the other man in the most correct light, and reminds us of that most necessary thing: tolerance, patience, forbearance, and love of one's neighbor, which everyone needs, and each of us therefore owes to another. A few sentences later, he adds a thought that could serve well as an opening paragraph in a contemporary textbook of psychotherapy. "We should treat with indulgence every human folly, failing, and vice, bearing in mind that what we have before us are simply our own failings, follies, and vices. For they are just the failings of mankind to which we also belong, and accordingly we have all the same failings buried within ourselves. We should not be indignant with others for these vices simply because they do not appear in us at the moment." Pururga and Paralipomena was a great success, generating several compilations of selections published separately under more popular titles: Aphorisms on Practical Wisdom, Counsels and Maxims, The Wisdom of Life, Living Thoughts of Schopenhauer, The Art of Literature, Religion, A Dialogue. Soon Schopenhauer's words were on the tongue of the entire educated German public. Even in neighboring Denmark, Kierkegaard wrote in his 1854 journal that "all the literary gossips, journals, and authorlings have begun to busy themselves with S." Praise ultimately appeared in the press. Great Britain, Arthur's almost birthplace, was the first to honor him with a stunning review of all of his work, titled Iconoclasm in German Philosophy, in the prestigious Westminster Review. Shortly afterward, this review was translated and widely read in Germany. Similar articles quickly appeared in France and Italy, and Schopenhauer's life changed dramatically. Curious visitors flocked to the Englischer Hof to eye the philosopher at lunch. Richard Wagner sent him the original libretto of The Ring of the Nibelungs with a dedication. Universities began to teach his work. Learned societies issued invitations for membership. Eulogistic letters arrived in the post. His previous books appeared in bookstores. Townspeople greeted him on his walks. And pet stores had a run on poodles similar to Schopenhauer's. Schopenhauer's rapture and delight were very evident. He wrote, "If a cat is stroked, it purrs. And just as inevitably, if a man is praised, sweet rapture and delight are reflected in his face.
and expressed the hope that the morning sun of my fane will gild with its first rays the evening of my life and dispel its gloom. When the eminent sculptress, Elizabeth Ney, visited Frankfurt for 4 weeks to do a bust of him, Arthur purred. She works all day at my place. When I get home, we have coffee together. We sit together on the sofa. And I feel as if I were married. Not since the best years of his life. The 2 years spent as a child in the Havre with the de Blessemer family. Had Arthur spoken so tenderly and contentedly of domestic life? 40. At the end of his life, no man, if he be sincere and in possession of his faculties, would ever wish to go through it again. Rather than this, he will much prefer to choose complete non-existence. Members filed in for the penultimate meeting with contrasting feelings. Some felt sorrow about the looming end of the group. Some thought about personal work they had left undone. Some scanned Julius's face as though to imprint it in their minds. And all were enormously curious about Pam's response to Philip's revelations of the previous meeting. But Pam did not offer satisfaction. Instead, she extracted a sheet of paper from her purse, slowly unfolded it, and read aloud. A carpenter does not come up to me and say, "Listen to me discourse about the art of carpentry." Instead, he makes a contract for a house and builds it. Do the same thing yourself. Eat like a man. Drink like a man. Get married. Have children. Take part in civic life. Learn how to put up with insults and tolerate other people. Then turning to Philip, she said, written by, guess who? Philip shrugged. Your man, Epictetus. That's why I bring it here. I know you revere him. You brought Julius one of his fables. Why am I quoting him? I'm merely speaking to the point raised by Tony and Stuart and others last week that you've never been in life. I believe that you selectively pick and choose various passages from philosophers to support your position and... Gil interrupted. Pam, this is our next to last meeting. If this is another one of your get Philip tirades, I don't personally feel I've got time for it. Do what you tell me to do. Get real and talk about your feelings. You must have had strong reactions to what Philip said about you last meeting.
No, no, hear me out, Pam said quickly. This is not get Philip stuff. My motivations are different. The iron is cooling. I'm trying to say something helpful to Philip. I think he's compounded his life avoidance by selectively gathering support from philosophy. He draws from Epictetus when he needs him and overlooks the same Epictetus when he doesn't. That's a great point, Pam, said Rebecca. You're putting your finger on something important. You know, I bought a copy of a little paperback called The Wisdom of Schopenhauer at a used bookstore, and have been skimming it the last couple of nights. It's all over the place. Some of it's fabulous and some outrageous. There's a passage I read yesterday that floored me. He says that if we go into any cemetery, knock on the tombstones, and ask the spirits dwelling there if they'd like to live again, every one of them would emphatically refuse. She turned to Philip. You believe this? Without waiting for him to respond, Rebecca continued. Well, I don't. He's not speaking for me. I'd like to check it out. Could we get a vote here?
I choose to live again. Life's a bitch, but it's a kick, too, said Tony. A chorus of me too spread around the group. I hesitate for one reason, explained Julius. The idea of once again bearing the pain of my wife's death. But even so, I'd say yes. I love being alive. Only Philip held silent. Sorry, he said.
but I agree with Schopenhauer. Life is suffering from start to finish. It would have been better if life, all life, had never been.
Better not have been for whom? Asked Pam. For Schopenhauer, you mean? Apparently not for the folks in this room.
Schopenhauer is hardly alone in his position. Consider the millions of Buddhists. Remember that the first of the Buddhist Four Noble Truths is that life is suffering.
Is that a serious answer, Philip? What's happened to you? When I was a student, you lectured brilliantly on modes of philosophical argument. What kind of argument is this? Truth by proclamation? Truth by appeal to authority? That's the way of religion. And yet surely you follow Schopenhauer in his atheism. And has it occurred to you that Schopenhauer was chronically depressed? And that the Buddha lived in a place and at a time when human suffering, pestilence, starvation, was rampant? And that, indeed, life then was unmitigated suffering for most? Has it occurred? What kind of philosophic argument is that? Retorted Philip. Every halfway literate sophomore student knows the difference between genesis and validity. Wait, wait, interjected Julius. Let's pause for a minute and check in. He scanned the group. How are the rest of you guys feeling about the last few minutes? Good stuff, said Tony. They're really duking it out, but with padded gloves. Right, better than silent glares and hidden daggers, said Gil. Yeah, I liked it a lot better, agreed Bonnie. Sparks were flying between Pam and Philip, but cooler sparks.
Me too, said Stuart. Until the last couple of minutes. Stuart, said Julius. In your first meeting here, you said your wife accused you of talking in telegrams.
Yep, you're stingy today. A few more words won't cost you any more, said Bonnie.
Right. Maybe I'm regressing because, you know, this being the next to last meeting, can't be sure. I don't feel sad. As usual, I have to infer my feelings. Here's something I do know, Julius. I love your taking care of me, calling on me, staying on my case. How's that? That's great. And I'll keep doing it. You said you liked Pam and Philip talking until the last couple of minutes. So what about those last minutes? At first it felt good-natured, more like a family squabble. But that last comment by Philip, that had a nasty edge to it. I mean the comment starting with, every halfway literate sophomore student. I didn't like that, Philip. It was a put-down. If you said that to me, I'd have felt insulted. And threatened. I'm not even sure what philosophical argument means.
I agree with Stuart, said Rebecca. Tell me, Philip, what were you feeling? Did you want to insult Pam?
Insult her? No, not at all. That was the last thing I wanted to do, responded Philip. I felt, uplifted or released, not sure of the right word, by her saying the iron was no longer red hot. Let's see, what else? I knew that one of her motives in bringing in the quote by Epictetus was to trap and confound me. That was obvious. But I kept in mind what Julius said to me when I brought in that fable for him, that he was pleased by the effort and the caring behind the act. So, said Tony, let me pull a Julius. Here's what I hear. You intended one thing, but your words resulted in another thing entirely. Philip looked quizzical. I mean, said Tony, you said that insulting Pam was the last thing in the world you wanted to do. Yet that was exactly what you did, wasn't it? Philip reluctantly nodded agreement. So, Tony continued, sounding like a triumphant attorney in cross-examination, you need to get your intentions and your behavior on the same page. You need to get them congruent. Do I have the word right?
Tony looked at Julius, who nodded his head. And that's why you should be in therapy. Congruence is what therapy is all about.
Well argued, said Philip. I have no counter-argument. You're right. That is why I need therapy.
What?
Tony could not believe his ears. He glanced at Julius, who gave him an attaboy nod.
Catch me, I'm going to faint, said Rebecca, who slumped back in her chair. Me too, echoed Bonnie and Gil, slumping back as well.
Philip looked around at the sight of half the group in mock unconsciousness. And, for the first time since entering the group, grinned.
Philip ended the group's levity by returning to the issue of his personal approach to counseling. Rebecca's discussion of Schopenhauer's tombstone comment implies that my approach or any approach based on his point of view is invalid. Lest you forget, I struggled for years with a serious affliction which Julius failed to cure, and I was only healed by patterning my path upon Schopenhauer's.
Julius instantly supported Philip. I don't deny you've done good work. Most therapists today would say it's not possible to overcome a severe sex addiction on your own. Contemporary treatment involves long-term work, I mean many years, in a structured recovery program consisting of individual therapy and groups meeting multiple times a week, often along 12-step principles. But no such recovery program existed back then. And frankly, I doubt whether you would have found it compatible. So, Julius continued, I want to go on record as saying that your feat is remarkable. The techniques by which you controlled your runaway drives worked. Better than anything I offered, even though I gave it my best shot.
I've never thought otherwise, said Philip. But here's a question, Philip. Is there a possibility your methods are now superannuated?
Super what? Asked Tony.
Superannuated, whispered Philip, who was sitting next to Tony. Super, Latin for beyond, plus annus, years. In other words, outmoded, obsolete.
Tony nodded his thanks. The other day, Julius continued, when I was wondering how to bring this home to you, an image came to mind. Imagine an ancient city that built a high wall to protect it from the wild torrents of an adjacent river. Centuries later, though the river had long dried up, the city still invested considerable resources in maintaining that wall.
You mean, said Tony, continuing to use some solution even when the problem had gone away?
Like wearing a bandage long after the cut had healed.
Precisely, said Julius. Maybe the bandage is a better metaphor. Right to the point.
I don't agree, Philip addressed both Julius and Tony, that my wound is healed, or that containment is no longer necessary. For proof, one need only look at my extreme discomfort levels in this group.
That's not a good measure, said Julius. You've had little experience with intimacy, with expressing feelings directly, with getting feedback and disclosing yourself. This is new for you. You've been in seclusion for years, and I toss you into this high-powered group. Of course that's going to feel uncomfortable. But what I'm really referring to is the overt problem, the sexual compulsion. And perhaps that's gone. You're older, been through a lot. Maybe you've entered the land of gonadal tranquility. Nice place, good sunny climate. I've dwelled there comfortably for many years. I would say, Tony added, that Schopenhauer has cured you. But now you need to be saved from the Schopenhauer cure.
Philip opened his mouth to respond, but then closed it and pondered Tony's statement.
Another thing,
Julius added. When you think about your stress in the group, don't forget the heavy-duty pain and guilt you faced here as a result of a chance encounter with a person from your past.
I've heard nothing about guilt from Philip, said Pam.
Philip responded instantly, facing Pam. If I had known then what I know now about the years of pain you suffered, I would never have done what I did. As I said before, you were unlucky to have crossed my path. The person I was then did not think of consequences. Automatic pilot. That person was on automatic pilot.
Pam nodded and caught his glance. Philip held it for a moment and then turned his attention back to Julius.
I grasp your point about the magnitude of the interpersonal stress in this group, but I insist that is only part of the picture. And it is here that our basic orientations are at odds. I agree there is stress in relationships with other beings, and possibly reward as well. I'll grant you that last point, though I myself have never known it. Nonetheless, I'm convinced that in the very state of existing there is tragedy and suffering. Permit me to cite Schopenhauer for only 2 minutes. Without waiting for a response, Philip, staring upward, began reciting. In the first place, a man never is happy but spends his whole life in striving after something which he thinks will make him so. He seldom attains his goal and, when he does, it is only to be disappointed. He is mostly shipwrecked in the end, and comes into harbor with masts and riggings gone. And then it is all one whether he has been happy or miserable, for his life was never anything more than a present moment, always vanishing, and now it is over. After a long silence, Rebecca said,
That sends shivers up my back. I know what you mean, said Bonnie.
I know I'm sounding like an uptight English professor, said Pam, addressing the entire group. But I urge you, don't be misled by rhetoric. That quote adds nothing of substance to what Philip has been saying all along. It only says it more persuasively. Schopenhauer was a brilliant stylist and wrote the best prose of any philosopher. Except for Nietzsche, of course. No one wrote better than Nietzsche. Philip, I want to respond to your comment about our basic orientations, said Julius. I don't believe we're as far apart as you think. I don't disagree with much that you and Schopenhauer have said about the tragedy of the human condition. Where you go east and I go west is when we turn to the question of what to do about it. How shall we live? How to face our mortality? How to live with the knowledge that we are simply life forms, thrown into an indifferent universe with no preordained purpose? As you know, Julius continued, though I'm more interested in philosophy than most therapists, I'm no expert. Yet I'm aware of other bold thinkers who have not flinched from these raw facts of life, and who have arrived at entirely different solutions from Schopenhauer. I'm thinking particularly of Camus, Sartre, and Nietzsche, who all advocate life engagement rather than Schopenhauer's pessimistic resignation. The one I know best is Nietzsche. You know, when I first received my diagnosis and was in a state of panic, I opened Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and was both calmed and inspired, especially by his life-celebratory comment that we should live life in such a manner that we'd say yes if we were offered the opportunity to live our life again and again in precisely the same manner. How did that relieve you? Asked Philip. I looked at my life and felt that I had lived it right. No regrets from inside, though of course I hated the outside events that took my wife from me. It helped me decide how I should live my remaining days. I should continue doing exactly what had always offered me satisfaction and meaning.
I didn't know that about you and Nietzsche, Julius, said Pam.